thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Judy Bolton Fassman, author of the new book, Asylum, A Memoir of Family Secrets. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. You've probably seen the astonishing photos that have been sent back in the past couple of weeks from the James Webb Telescope, launched by NASA last December, and now a million miles out in space. The Webb Telescope is 100 times more powerful than the old Hubble Telescope, launched 32 years ago and still operating, and for $10 billion, only $10 billion, we are getting a glimpse towards the beginning of time that was never possible before. Most astronomers and astrophysicists believe that the initial moment of creation, the Big Bang, took place around 13.7 billion years ago, when the first stars began to burn, shining forth with primordial light and creating the elements that compose, well, everything in the universe. The 21-foot Webb telescope, covered in golden mirrors, can see light from 13.6 billion years ago, shockingly close to the beginning of everything, you know, only 100 million years away or something, light that has been traveling towards us for all that extraordinary length of time, from the moment of what we in Judaism call Bereshit, the inception of creation. And what photos this telescope has shared with us. Amazing images of exploding colors, stars upon stars upon stars, nebulae exploding into existence in star nurseries, beautiful and wonderful. And also, just slightly intimidating, there are so many galaxies out there, such a profusion of light energy radiating everywhere. It's a little like the first users of telescopes must have felt back in the 1500s when they looked out at the night sky and saw just how much more there was in the heavens than the naked eye could ever discern. It's a reminder that we are all, in essence, made out of stars. The carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen that compose most of our own bodies were generated the moment the first stars began burning. We truly are created from starlight, forged at the beginning of everything. What is it Shakespeare wrote? There was a star danced, and under that was I born, or perhaps out of that was I born. That initial beginning that these images move us so dramatically towards came in Jewish scriptural text in Genesis, and of course in Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, from a flow of divine light energy of creation. Yehi Or, let there be light. And now we can see closer to those initial moments than ever before. There's something fascinating about harmonizing our tradition's understanding of creation as described in the Torah with contemporary scientific discoveries and observations about cosmology. How did our ancient ancestors thousands of years ago have such a profound understanding that it all began with light energy, when they could see only a tiny part of what we now observe with ever-growing clarity? How did the ancient and medieval mystics evolve a complicated Jewish theory of divinity expressed as the outpouring of powerful light energy or into a void creating everything? How did they develop a magnificently poetic version of a scientific theory that wasn't articulated even until the middle of the 20th century? What element of sacred inspiration led them to see this initial creation with startling clarity,
when the most they could observe with their own eyes was a smattering of pinpricks of light in a dark night sky. You don't have to be a mystic to enjoy the images we have begun to receive from that remarkable and, of course, over-budget and long-delayed telescope that is peering into the origins of existence. But as a longtime teacher of Zohar, the greatest text of Jewish mysticism, I must celebrate this exceptional human achievement and the astounding images we are enjoying now, how they enrich our experience, not only of Judaism and science, but of understanding it all. To play us in this morning, here's Chana Senesh's great poem, Yesh Kochavim. There are stars so far away we only see their light once they are long gone. As sung by Rochelle Schubert, in a setting by Jeff Klepper.
There are stars up above, so far away we only see their light. Long, long after the star itself is gone. And so it is with people that we loved. Their memories keep shining ever brightly, though their time with us is done. But the stars that light up the darkest night, these are the lights that guide us as we live our days. These are the ways we remember. We remember as we live our days. These are the ways we remember. We remember. Yesh kochavim she'oram magia artza, rak ka'asher hem atzmam avdu ve'inam. Yesh anashim she'ziv zikron me'ir, ka'asher hem atzmam inam od bitochenu. Orot eleham avikim beheshkat halayim, hem hem shemarim la'adam et haderech, et haderech, hem hem shemarim la'adam et haderech, et haderech. As we live our days, these are the ways we remember. We remember. As we live our days, these are the ways we remember. We remember. We remember, we remember.
That was Yesh Kochavim, originally created by Kol Beseder, cantor Jeff Klepper, and my good friend Rabbi Danny Freelander. There are stars, to a text by the great poet and Holocaust martyr Chana Senesh. Our guest this morning, Judy Bolton Fassman, is the daughter of an Ashkenazic World War II U.S. Navy lieutenant commander and a volatile Cuban Sephardic beauty queen. Her new memoir explores that complicated family and its deep secrets. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Judy Bolton Fassman is the author of the new, really fascinating memoir, Asylum. It's subtitled A Memoir of Family Secrets, and it certainly is that. She has written in a wide variety of major newspapers, literary magazines, won
number of different awards for her creative writing. She's a beautiful writer. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, boy, you're not kidding. A memoir of family secrets. This must have been a pretty difficult family to grow up in.
Yeah. It was and it wasn't. It was a blessing and a curse because it's great for a writer to grow up in a family like that because there's so much to probe when you get older. But it was, you know, I'm very forthright about saying that it was difficult at times in the book.
Your dad was an Ashkenazic Jew. He didn't marry till he was 40. Your mom, a Cuban Jew, very different background, 17 years his junior. Tell us a little bit about that marriage, because that's a large part of the focus of the story.
It is. Well, there was a huge gap, as you mentioned. There was a cultural gap. There was a generational gap. And within that gap, a lot of things happened. A lot of stories happened. My mother was a colorful character, as you know from the book, and my father carried a lifelong secret. Well, a secret from the time he was very young, and he died with that secret. And I'm not going to do a spoiler. I don't want to say what.
No spoiler alerts here.
No, so I don't want to do that. But It was, you know, I learned a lot. I gained a second language. I gained an appreciation of culture. I gained an appreciation of America through my father, who was fiercely patriotic. And I also felt very Latinx as well. So that dual identity has really informed my life, and it's informed my writing. I use a lot of Spanish words in the narrative. And I think it adds to the story. It amplifies the story, and it introduces me to readers. Introduces me to how I grew up.
When you write about something so intensely personal, do you sometimes want to hold back what you're writing? You don't seem to do so here.
I do sometimes, but I felt that this was my story to tell, and this book took me years to write. And it took me years to reconcile to the fact that this was my story and this happened to me. And I tried to be very careful in maintaining that boundary that it was my story and everything in the book happened to me or I witnessed personally or heard about it from a very, very reliable source.
When we come back on Too Jewish in a moment, we'll hear much more from Judy Bolton Fassman. The book is Asylum, A Memoir of Family Secrets. Beautifully written book. We'll talk much more with her when we come back here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New Progressive Congregation in Northwest Tucson of the Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services Friday night or Saturday morning, or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person or on Facebook. Call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson. Our services with full music are available in our sanctuary Friday night at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning at 10 a.m., in person. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Our service is also on Facebook Live. You can access all of them through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. And our wonderful religious school is signing kids up right now, available in blended format too. Students live and some coming on Zoom. Join us for our pool party as we splash into school in early August. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, including a new Musar class starting in August, all taught live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing congregation in all of Arizona and its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, T-O-O, JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Please post a rating, review Too Jewish, give us a good one whenever you listen to our podcast. All of those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about what makes for a successful Jewish community, and you talked about a couple of things. If it's more focused on unity than splintering, but also whether it has certain kinds of experiences that unite the group. You have a good story about one of those experiences.
Well, I think I've told this story before on your show, which is when I visited Kabul as a teenager, the capital of Afghanistan. There used to be a Jewish community there. It was fairly small. It was very old. And it had been shrinking. A lot of Jews had been leaving for Israel. But there were still a few dozen. And what was striking to me when I was there was that both morning and evening, most, if not all, of the adult men in the community would come to the synagogue and join a minyan. But the main purpose wasn't to pray. It was to exchange daily news and gossip and what happened in the market today and how are exchange rates going and what's the black market rate, whatever.
How's your wife? Is she recovered from that surgery? That kind of
but
stuff.
But that kind of daily exchange and kind of seeing everybody in the community is certainly one thing that makes a community stronger. Another thing that makes a community stronger is if there is a really dedicated, energetic, capable leader, whether it's a Jewish professional like a rabbi or a teacher or a chazan, or a layperson who's maybe, you know, the president of the community or just a community activist or an organizer.
Or sometimes someone who wants to fund development within a community. That matters too.
No, but you still have to have somebody who can use the funds capably.
Of course.
So, I mean, funding helps. I don't think it's the essential.
Right.
I think I also once told on your show the story of the chief rabbi of Montenegro, a place which I had known before but never knew that there were any Jews there. And this rabbi's finding Jews everywhere, but they're mostly people with a Jewish parent or a Jewish grandparent or whatever. But they see him, they open up, and before you know it, every year he has a communal Passover Seder in a country that theoretically has no Jews for 300 people. And he gets kosher food from Israel, and he's just a ball of energy and of dedication and enthusiasm, and everybody responds to him.
You know, I'm thinking of a couple of things. One is somebody said to me recently, you know, Rabbi, you always have food after services every Friday night, every Saturday. And I thought, like, you don't really need that. We don't need a meal. I mean, and then I realized, like, people stick around and they get to know each other and they become part of each other's life and it's real community. And they said, it doesn't matter what the food is. I said, no, it has to taste good, because otherwise it's not Jewish food. But for me, that was one of the ways that we are building community, to build real community in which everybody expects it and they hang around and they have a drink together. And if they can't stay, they apologize that they can't stay for the meal and they want to do Birkat Hamazon. And it all becomes, you know, kind of building those relationships. Even now, I'm not saying that people should come just for the meal and skip services or the study session, but it all becomes part of the culture.
Right.
Do you, I feel like we could talk more about this because there's other aspects, but certainly that sense that community is both Jewish religious experience and relationships and relationship building, that's essential to the development and the integrity of successful communities. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Oh my goodness, Sarah, you lost so much weight. How'd you do it? Oy, Goldie, my no good husband is cheating on me. I'm so depressed, I can't eat a bite. So, Sarah, why don't you divorce him? Well, Goldie, to tell you the truth, I need to lose another 10 pounds. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections in the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both portions teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in quite different ways. The setting for these final parshiot, these final portions in the book of Numbers, is the border of the Promised Land. The Israelites approach Canaan now for a second time after a 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. "We like the land we're traveling through now, right here, the east bank of the Jordan, what is today the country of Jordan." The leaders of Reuben and Gad say, "Let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." Moses agrees, but in curious language. First he tells them, "Build towns for your children, then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message is clear. Families come first, our professions and income second. It is a human message and one that we need to relearn in every generation. Put family first. Then in the very last section of Numbers, Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts, justice in cases of manslaughter or even murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by killing. If you killed someone intentionally or accidentally, even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you'd done the deed, you would likely be executed by their kinsmen. Which meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were totally innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, they wouldn't help much. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to the cycles of revenge, the sorts of blood feuds Mark Twain described in the Hatfield and McCoy saga several millennia later, this kind of clan murder revenge cycles that take place even today in Palestinian Arab towns in the West Bank and Gaza. To preclude this looming social disaster, the Torah portion of Maaseh provided for 6 cities of refuge to be built in and around the land of Israel. No person who entered those cities could be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge was a kind of protection, guarantee of due process. That's become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet, the Torah established that principle some 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder, or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of murder and revenge, well, we don't know. But we do know that the Torah teaches us in this very different way that the most basic unit of society had to be nurtured, maintained, and protected, that its positive values had to be strengthened even in the most trying situations. A great message, still. When we return on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Judy Bolton-Fassman, explains just how she came to discover her own family's great secret and lose it in nearly the same moment. It's a great story. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Well, it was a historic news scoop, but also a big diplomatic and religious problem. The first Israeli-Jewish reporter to document the annual Muslim pilgrimage of Hajj went on an unprecedented visit to the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. But when the footage of Channel 13 correspondent Gil Tamari in Mecca aired last week, the public reception in Israel and in the Muslim world was sharply critical. As Tamari states on air, entry to Islam's holiest site is forbidden to members of any other religion, and it's illegal under Saudi law. Tamari, who is in the country on a special invitation by the Saudi government to cover President Joe Biden's diplomatic visit to the region, decided to enter Mecca without permission in search of an exclusive story. But immediately after the show aired, social media blazed with outrage over his act and the outlet's decision to air the footage. Both the reporter and Channel 13 issued apologies, saying they didn't mean to offend, but defended the segment as an important journalistic accomplishment and great journalism. Tamari's foray comes as Israel and Saudi Arabia are engaged in a delicate effort to improve relations. It's seen as crucial to managing the mutual threat of Iran. Some worry that Tamari's trip will disrupt those ties. The footage that was shown on Channel 13 in Israel opens with Tamari announcing his intentions. "The city is closed to anyone who isn't Muslim. You can't enter," he says. "It was clear that I had no chance of visiting Mecca, but I was able to find the right person who agreed to risk himself and take me on a trip." To protect the safety of his guide, they blurred the face and distorted his voice. Tamara Ann, the guide, came up with a cover story in case they were stopped by authorities, saying they were visiting a fake friend in Mecca. In the broadcast, they pass road signs indicating non-Muslims are not allowed to proceed. They lower the camera as they go through police checkpoints. When they reach the sacred site of Mount Arafat, they exit the car, and Tamari's guide could be heard saying, "This whole thing is illegal." Indeed. Tamari begins speaking to the camera in Hebrew, whispering to avoid detection. "Only Muslims are allowed here. No Israeli journalist has ever broadcast from here," Tamari says. "I was confident no one noticed me, but apparently I was attracting too much attention. My guide suddenly touched my shoulder. Using our agreed-upon sign, it's time to get away. He heard one of the religious people say that I need to be approached to see if I am a Muslim. We raise suspicions here, and we are escaping." Now, the Israeli reporter Tamari did not actually enter the Haram, the Grand Mosque in Mecca, or approach the black cube-shaped rock of the Kaaba. But according to Saudi Arabian law, any non-Muslim is forbidden entry into the whole urban area of Mecca. That, of course, would include Jews of any nationality. By the way, the first non-Muslim to vividly chronicle a visit to Mecca, I think, was the 19th century British explorer Sir Richard Burton. Not the actor who married Elizabeth Taylor a couple of times, but the original Sir Richard Burton, who was, well, quite a guy. Fluent in 29 languages and many cultures. Sir Richard Burton had himself circumcised, dressed as a Muslim, attached himself to a caravan, going first to Medina and then Mecca, became totally familiar with the ways to conduct himself on a Hajj, called himself Haji Abdullah, and slipped into Mecca and Haram and saw the Kaaba. Burton may have actually been kind of Muslim by that time. His own religious convictions changed dramatically over his life. He wrote about his own visit to Mecca in a best-selling book of the time, Personal Narrative of Pilgrimage to Al-Madinah and Mecca, published in 1855. He noted that if he had been caught while in Mecca, he would surely have been executed. You know, when I took a sabbatical trip around the world in 2015 and visited 20 countries and 148 of the holiest places on earth, Mecca certainly qualified as one of the sacred sites I most wished to see and write about, some 160 years after Richard Burton did. There were, I was told, ways it could be done. I might have arranged the appropriate letters and learned enough Quran to fake it all. But the idea of a rabbi pretending to be a Muslim so he could visit the Kaaba while on a personal quest to discover what is holy about all the sacred sites in the world seemed so utterly hypocritical and antithetical to the values I represent, I decided quickly, if regretfully, that it was one place I would not manage to see and write about. But apparently Channel 13 in Israel and Gil Tamari felt differently. Israeli political consultant Lenny Ben-David added his voice to the condemnation. "With great shame, I express my personal apology for the sacrilegious and irresponsible entry of a Jewish Israeli reporter into the holy Islamic city of Mecca," he wrote. "Condemnation of his action and video have been heard across Israel, the act of a fool." Indeed. I'm afraid I have to agree, but I doubt that even this silly incident will slow the steady creep towards diplomatic relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. You know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Iran is changing things in ways it never intended. In happier and quite different news, Ben Platt, the Jewish Broadway phenomenon, sang the national anthem before the 2022 Major League Baseball All-Star Game last week at Dodger Stadium in his own hometown. Platt, born and raised in L.A., was a musical star at Camp Ramah and then moved to New York, struck it big on Broadway, of course. His breakout role, reprised last year on screen, was in Dear Evan Hansen. Platt's appearance at the All-Star Game comes amid a schedule of Jewish-themed roles. Platt will star in the musical comedy movie Theater Camp, filming right now at a Jewish summer camp that closed in 2019, and in a revival of the Broadway musical Parade about the 1915 Klan lynching of Leo Frank in Atlanta. Before Platt, the most recent Jewish singer to sing the national anthem of the baseball All-Star Game was Rachel Platten in 2016. Her song, Fight Song became the theme of Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful presidential bid a few weeks later. And Idina Menzel, another Jewish Broadway star, performed the All-Star Anthem in 2014. Ben Platt, a Romanic who has performed Jewish liturgical songs with his brothers, was not the only prominent Jew to take the field at the All-Star Game. Max Fried of the Braves and Jock Peterson of the Giants were both on the roster. And the Maccabiah, somehow they pronounce it. Anyway, the Jewish Olympics took place in Israel over the past week. Usually held every 4 years, this one was postponed a year because of COVID. The 21st Maccabiah Games included 10,000 participants from 80 countries all over the world, competing in 42 sporting events. The first Maccabiah Games were held in 1932, by the way, in pre-state Israel, and Jewish competitors from anywhere in the world and all Israeli citizens are eligible to compete. It's the largest sporting event in the entire world in 2022, and if you have a chance to watch the opening ceremonies on YouTube, you should. They were great fun. Joe Biden became the first U.S. president to attend the Maccabiah, speaking to the 1,400 American competitors before the opening ceremony. The closing ceremonies of the Maccabiah will be held, by the way, tomorrow night. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Judy Bolton Fassman has a new book, Asylum, a Memoir of Family Secrets. It is a fascinating and beautifully written book, and very confessional in some ways about her own identity. Her Cuban-born Sephardic mother, Matilde Albuquerque Bolton.
Perfect. Albuquerque. Yep. Okay.
And her father, K. Harold Bolton, very Ashkenazi in background, from Ukrainian Jews who had moved here. We talked earlier in the show about the 17-year difference between them when they married. They almost didn't marry, and that's not giving away too much, because your dad broke off the wedding like 3 weeks before it was supposed to happen. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, he did. That was actually a very, that story really informed a lot of my childhood because there was a lot of bitterness around it, particularly from my mother. I think, you know, it was a combination of he got cold feet and they were supposed to be married in Havana in December of 1959. And I think that he was really worried about what was happening with Castro at the time. Castro was coming down from the Sierra Mountains and he was having more of an influence in Cuba. And I think my father and his family were very wary of that. But mostly, I think my dad was wary of my mom. She was not an easy woman. She was very dramatic. I think that he just, you know, he really got cold feet about that. And in some ways, if you read the book, you'll know he was right.
Well, I mean, there's some really remarkable quotes from your mom. You know, I'm a descendant of the Duke of Albuquerque, which makes me a Sephardic duchess. You know, that was not your dad's style at all.
No, but it's funny that you mentioned that, because I do have a little anecdote about that. My dad graduated from Yale in 1940 and almost immediately entered the service, entered the Navy as an ensign. And Yale does a very nice 25th anniversary commemorative reunion book, or at least they did for the class of 1940 and 1965. And I remember reading that entry even as a kid, and my father said, you know, married late in life, wish I had done it sooner, married to Matilde Albuquerque Bolton, a teacher, a singer, and a descendant of the Duke of Albuquerque. So in some ways, I mean, I was as surprised to read that entry as you mentioned, because it really wasn't his style, but I think he was really... I think he was really interested in that background, and I think he was really, in some ways, proud of it.
You start the book with a story of your dad finally, like, revealing all in a letter. He already had Parkinson's, and then calling you and telling you to burn the letter, which has all the secrets of his background that you spend really the book discovering, and you burned the letter. That must have been really hard to do.
Well, I was in a very different frame of mind when I received that letter. I was in my early 20s. I was nursing a broken heart. I was trying to finish graduate school. I was living in the 92nd Street Y in a small room. And my father wrote to me frequently during that time, particularly that summer. And he wanted our correspondence to be secret. He did not want my mother to know it. And to know about that we were communicating without her knowledge. And he wrote me this letter, and it was different than other letters that he had sent me. It was kind of thick and, you know, taped. And I thought, well, this is interesting. I better not rip it open, you know, here at the mailbox. I'll go upstairs and see what this is all about. And, you know, like, the timing was perfect. There was, you know, in the old days, you had the answering machines, the red light flashing, and I knew that there was a message, and it was my dad. And he sounded very panicked, and he pretty much begged me to burn the letter. A lot of people ask if I have, and I did burn the letter, and a lot of people ask me if I have regrets about that. And I think there are two answers to that. The first was, at that point, my father and I had grown very close. We weren't that close when I was a little girl, but we had grown very close at that point. And I wanted to honor his wishes. And the other reason is I was just terrified of what was inside that letter. I knew he had Parkinson's, or he was at the beginning stages of Parkinson's. And I knew he was desperately unhappy with my mother. And I didn't know what was in it, and I was afraid it was going to be some sort of goodbye note to me, some sort of, you know, I don't know, self-styled suicide note. I just, you know, the terror really overtook me, and I burned it. I burned it at his behest.
And then you spent a lot of time later trying to find out what was in that letter.
Absolutely.
Perhaps.
I mean, in some ways, it launched two things launched my journey in this book. That it always haunted me that I burned the letter. I mean, as I said, I don't regret it, but I do remember vividly burning it. And, you know, I did a little what-ifing about it throughout the years. And the other thing that launched the journey was to write this book was saying the Kaddish for my father, or deciding to say the Kaddish for my father every day for almost a year. That wasn't something that I decided lightly. In fact, it wasn't something that I even decided I was going to do. I said, well, you know, I'm going to give myself 30 days, and I'm going to keep a journal about it. And then 30 days morphed into 2 months. And by the time Thanksgiving rolled around, my father was buried on the eve of Rosh Hashanah. It had become part of my life, and I was enjoying a posthumous relationship with my dad. You know, I made time for him every day. when I went to go say the Kaddish. And as you know, you can't say the Kaddish alone, and there are various reasons for that, which I think are very smart, one of them being you don't want to be isolated as a mourner. And, you know, I had two young kids at the time, and, you know, sometimes they went with me in their pajamas to Minyans. But I was determined to say the Kaddish every day, and I did manage to do it for 11 months.
You had a really strong Jewish background. You went to cheder, yeshiva, and experienced some of the sexism inherent in growing up Orthodox, I think, and you explained that quite beautifully as well. But it didn't turn you off. This journey into your past, it's not a uniquely Jewish journey, but it feels very Jewish.
Yeah, I think... You know, I have a lot of respect for the people who taught me at the yeshiva. In my last year, as I write, the Lubavitch came in and sort of took over the school.
Right.
And I have a lot of respect for the Lubavitchers. I think they do great work. Even though I was interested in that life, in the end, I knew it wasn't for me. And at the time, it really upset my parents. They thought they were losing me because I wanted to go to Borough Park, and there was no way they were sending their 14-year-old kid away to school.
Right.
So they gave me two choices, both of them being an all-girls school, and one of those schools was the local all-girls Catholic high school. And I took that option thinking that I would last 2 weeks and that they would give in. Well, I lasted 3 years, and I absolutely loved it there. It was a new era for the Sisters of Mercy. Many of them were younger. Many of them wore jeans. Only the older nuns wore habits, and they were very cool and very accepting, and I had a great experience there.
So... what was the biggest surprise, without giving away anything, in this quest of yours?
Well, I have to tell you, the secret wasn't the biggest surprise, because I was always suspicious of it.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of intuit a lot of it. I think that one of the bigger surprises was that I actually stuck to saying the Kaddish, because I was, as I said, I was a young mother then, and I had kids, and it was difficult to work around that sometimes. And I think that I also gained a more empathy for my parents, particularly my mother, who was very difficult throughout much of my life. And the challenge I set up for myself, and that's why the book took so long, was that I wanted to write about them, or particularly my mother, with kavod, with honor, with respect. And I hope I achieved that, because it was quite a challenge. And, you know, I literally threw away a lot of pages before I thought I got to that place.
There's aspects of this book that I don't think you could have discovered until fairly recently. You know, some of it was research that existed, you know, looking back at your dad's war history or Yale archives, all those kinds of things. But some of it depended on, you know, kind of modern developments. You wrote this over a number of years. Did things sort of jump out at you as being available now that hadn't been available earlier?
Well, certainly the internet was a big help, because that's how I located a few of my sources. So the internet certainly aided me in that, and I was very grateful for that. And, you know, the research itself, even though I did do library research, I consulted rabbis, you know, when it came to figuring out the history of the Kaddish, and I did a lot of book reading about it. All of that helped me. But, yes, certainly the advent of the internet, because I started the book in 2002, was a big factor in getting the book, you know, off the ground.
Gosh, I'm being so careful not to reveal some of the reveals in the book. But I don't think you need to hear them to understand what an interesting book it is. There's a really funny part early on where you talk about Judy Bolton, Girl Detective. I knew Nancy Drew. Judy Bolton was, I guess, like second tier Nancy Drew.
Well, I don't like to think of it that way, but
of course not. I'm so sorry.
No. I'm joking. But yeah, you hit the nail on the head. She was a secondary figure. She didn't have the shiny roadster, and she didn't have the boyfriend.
Yes, and because that was really just coincidence for you, right? That was just a name thing.
It was a name thing. I'm named for a cousin of my father's who had already passed away when I was born. I like to think, you know, my cousins had Judy Bolton books. My cousins are much older because of, you know, my father's age, my cousins on my dad's side. And I'm wondering if my dad sort of pushed, you know, they needed a J name. And I always wondered if my dad sort of pushed for that because he knew about the Judy Bolton book series. But it was a thrill as a kid to see those books, you know, to see my name on the cover of a book. It was great. But no, a lot of people don't know a lot about Judy Bolton now. But the interesting thing is I heard from the author of the series, Margaret Sutton, I heard from her daughter who found out about the book, read it, and wrote me a very nice note.
I guess the last question I have for you is, did completing this book give you sort of a greater sense of peace?
Yes, it did. That's a really good question, and I think it did. It took a long while to achieve that peace, because a lot of times I felt I was almost, I think I write in the book, you know, trying to describe a painting like a blind woman, you know, standing in front of a painting like a blind person. And but I think at the end, and I'm not giving anything away, when I go back to the chapel that my parents were married in New York City at the Sephardic synagogue, on Central Park West, and I say the Kaddish for my father, I think that indicates that that I did feel a measure of peace, and I think it reflects that.
I want to thank Judy Bolton Fastman for a great visit here on Two Jewish. The book Asylum, not only beautifully written, but really fascinating stuff. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
Well, I have a website, JudyBoltonFastman.com, and the book is available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, bookshop.org, and I would imagine you can order it through your local bookstore.
Always a good idea.
Yeah, great to support independence.
Judy, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be a good friend, storyteller extraordinaire Jim Weiss, a pioneer and hero in the unique field of sharing the greatest stories of history and culture with families. Don't forget, join us at Congregation Beis Simcha in person every Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat, always delicious, starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning to 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, all live in person and available on our Facebook page. We have wonderful new classes beginning in August, including a Musar series in cooperation with the J for adults, and religious school jumps into the year with a splash into school party. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish is the song Shomer Yisrael, Guardian of Israel, Guard the People of Israel. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Shomer, Shomer Yisrael, Shomer, Shomer Yisrael. Shemo Sherit Yisrael, Shemo Sherit Yisrael, Ve'ayavah Yisrael, Ha'omerim.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.